Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast spoiler specials. This one is dedicated to the Cloverfield Paradox. Ooh. It's the latest in the Cloverfield series and it made a splash when it suddenly appeared on Netflix and not in cinemas. Is it a game changer for the industry? Well, we shall see. But joining me over the next half hour or so to discuss the film and its ramifications, both for Cloverfield, the franchise, and for movies in general, are Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And Ben Travis.
Hello.
Newcomer to the podcast.
Back.
The Travis Paradox. You've just appeared magically.
I have popped in from an alternate dimension.
Very good.
To be here today, so thanks for having me.
Excellent. Otherwise known as Camden. All right, but before we get to talk about the film itself, Ben here spoke to the film's director, Julius Onah, and its producer, one Mr. J.J. Abrams, when they popped into London just after the film launched on Netflix, after all that hullabaloo with the Super Bowl trailer and whatnot. And you spoke about a great many spoilerific things in 15 minutes,
yeah, it was
roughly.
It was a short one, but we managed to touch a bit on the wider Cloverfield universe, some of the specific stuff in the film, some nice little Easter eggs and stuff.
Okay.
So I think there's some good tidbits in there if you're a big Cloverfield fan.
Fantastic. So, of course, this is a spoiler special. So if you have not seen the Cloverfield Paradox, then hie thee to your nearest cinema. No, wait. Hie thee to your nearest sofa. Watch the Cloverfield Paradox. And then come back here and listen to this, because we are going to go full spoilerific third act stuff and all after this. But first up, here are JJ and Julius talking to Ben. Enjoy.
So welcome to the Empire spoiler special for the Cloverfield Paradox. I'm very pleased to be joined by the director of the film, Julius Onah, and the Cloverfield overlord himself, JJ Abrams. How are you guys doing?
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
What a week.
Yeah. Nuts.
It's crazy.
This time last week, there wasn't a third Cloverfield film in the world. This week, there is. Has it been weird for you guys, having kept it so secret for so long, for then everyone to see it at once and to see on things like social media, seeing people discover it, discovering the secret, spreading spoilers, sharing their reactions?
You know, it's been thrilling. You know, we're not at all, just because, you know, we'd hoped that doing something like this, dropping it on the world this way, would be something that got a reaction, and it's, for me, it succeeded my wildest expectations.
You know, the idea that it actually was pulled off, that Netflix was able to do what they did, is just an absolute testament to their boldness, their incredible team, the way that they were that they worked together. Did about a year's worth of work in a month and a bit. Technologically speaking, you know, all the details that had to be worked out for this thing to happen, to do it in secret, and again, do it as sort of as brazenly as they did, was just wildly impressive to watch.
Yeah, what was the amount of time between it being decided that it was going to be a sort of surprise drop and then it actually dropping on Netflix?
It was a couple months of conversation, I guess, but it was, once it was all official and the marketing teams, you know, had to do their thing and all the materials needed to be put together, I mean, it was a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, 6 weeks or something.
Brilliant. So we're going to go full spoiler details now and talk about some of the really interesting and weird things that happen in this film. So let's go right to the very last shot, which is what looks like the original Cloverfield monster bursting through the clouds and letting out a gigantic roar. Did you guys specifically choose the original creature? Is it the same one from the first film? Because it looks a lot bigger than the original Cloverfield monster. Obviously, there seems to be some kind of alternate dimensions and 20-year time difference. What can you tell me about that final shot?
Well, it might be bigger or the Earth might be smaller.
Yeah.
It's the same creature, but definitely bigger.
Yeah. I mean, it was a baby in the first one, so, you know, maybe it started eating its Wheaties and a little bit.
When was that decided as the final shot, that this is the note that we're going to go out on this kind of full-on monster reveal, especially because with the original being handheld, you got kind of fleeting glimpses of the monster. This was like a full-on, really clean shot.
Well, as we were working on the movie, and you know, I know some people have said that, you know, it's it's not a good thing if things iterate. Mm-hmm. That things should originate, and they should, you know, you should be beholden to that original idea the whole time. I personally feel like when you're working on something and there are ideas that inspire you, it's never too late to say, hey, what about or what if, and try something. Mm-hmm. And this was something that happened. I mean, this is well into post-production, but we had this ending and there were alternate versions of a lot of things. But this idea came up, you know, a long time ago. And when we tried it, it made us laugh. It just felt like one of those things that, you know, especially with the mix that Will Files and the sounds that Robbie Stambler and, you know, Lindsay Alvarez also worked on. You know, when we were sitting in the theater, even when it was the rough version, mm-hmm. The sort of animatic, and this creature popped out, it made us laugh. So it was one of those things that it wasn't in the original script, mm-hmm. but as we worked on it, it felt like it was a fun way to, first of all, make literal the thing, and secondly, have it be the payoff mm-hmm. to this story that you were watching on Earth of, you know, what was happening on this planet while they were away in terms of the Michael story, mm-hmm. feeling like this might be a kind of military thing, ground invasion. You're not quite sure what it is. And then in the end, it's sort of, confirming that this was mm-hmm. sort of a monster movie happening simultaneous with the space station. Sorry. Yeah.
And talking about connections to the original Cloverfield as well, one of the original theories that kind of sprang out of that film was, again, at the very end when you seemingly see something fall into the water. Mm. With this introducing parallel dimensions and the two stations merging and one of them crashing out of the sky, is that a direct reference to that?
Yeah, it was for me, but...
Yeah, I mean, look, the nice thing about what that last shot did for us, and if you look back at the previous movies too, it was just opened a set of possibilities that were mm-hmm. very intriguing. And now that we've had these multiple timelines that have been opened and things that are happening interdimensionally, there's many different ways for these things to play out. So it was a real fun connection to make mm-hmm. with things dropping to the ocean that you see in the movie when they first realize they've landed in this other dimension. Mm-hmm. Without, I know it's a spoiler special, but there's still more possibilities that will come with mm-hmm. more strands of the story.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because one of the things the conspiracy theorist says on the news in the film is that they kind of introduce the idea of dimensions and demons, and as well, it specifically says in the past and the future. Mm-hmm. Was it always part of the plan when you were looking at how Cloverfield could expand to introduce a film that would open all those narrative possibilities that you can do a Cloverfield in any time period, in the future, in the past, in any dimension?
Well, it felt like a bit of an opportunity that was too good to pass up and kind of a catch-all. And on the one hand, you can say, well, then anything, anywhere could be a Cloverfield movie. And mm-hmm. and it's not... The intention has never been... take a movie and then slap Cloverfield on it. The idea was to say Cloverfield is a kind of umbrella, you know, under which all sorts of genres and thrill rides can take place. Mm-hmm. I know that there are some who feel like, oh, I want it to just be a linear narrative, and I totally get that. And it's what most sequels end up being. Mm-hmm. For us, the idea has always been, could there be spiritual successors and sequels that weren't literally a narrative sequel, but that had a connection to the original movie in the DNA of how we made it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with Cloverfield, it was this, the inspiration was what would happen if there was a monster movie and it was the point of view of, you know, the every man, every woman on the street. You rarely would get that. You know, most giant monster movies have these sort of God's eye view storylines, yeah. and you kind of pop between a bunch of different characters. This was a very sort of intentionally intimate, singular point of view. The second movie was an inspiration of, you know, another kind of what if, and that feeling of, you know, what if you find yourself being held captive by someone who might be crazy, but might also be right mm-hmm. about something, you know, hyper bizarre, supernatural sci-fi happening outside. This third one was, it began as this story on the space station. But what we realized was the opportunity for almost the way Poltergeist used a haunting mm-hmm. to allow for all these disparate elements. So what a stake crawling on a counter, or a bunch of chairs stacking up, or these, you know, corpses rising out of the pool, or a tree, or a toy clown coming to life and grabbing you, or a girl going into a television set, what all those things have to do with a haunting. It just, it allowed for crazy, weird shit you just want to see within a storyline that had a sort of excuse for it. So what we realized was, though this was a future story, there was an opportunity for us to create something that would give license to do things that were simply insane and reality bending and bizarre, but not even just in this movie, but also in the films that have preceded it and those that follow.
So from your guys' point of view, would you say that the events of the Cloverfield paradox is sort of like, is the big bang that allows all the other Cloverfield stuff to happen?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
So to go kind of all in on Cloverfield paradox. So one thing I thought was really interesting, you guys spoke about this, there being various iterations of the film along the line. The opening scene is actually a really lovely, quiet scene between Gugu's character and her husband, Michael. That really centres her as the protagonist for the film. But was there ever a version where Gugu's character wasn't initially denoted as the focus, but then kind of like Alien, where Ripley, over the course of the film, becomes the central character, it kind of zones in on her. Was there ever an iteration of the film like that?
Never. It's always been about Hamilton at the center of the story, mm-hmm. and the journey that this character goes on. And I think that was great for us as an anchor, because, you know, when you are in this situation where anything goes and anything's possible, you know, it's easy for, I think, the emotional journey of a story to lose its focus. But mm-hmm. having Hamilton at the center of the film was something that, I think, for all of us, kept it one foot on the ground. So as we kind of, you know, spiraled out there and did some of the wild, crazy things we did in the movie, we always knew we were going to be coming back to her. Mm-hmm. It allows you to, you know, have a gigantic monster in your movie, yet at the same time, you know, not lose track of who that anchor is emotionally. And you know, and Gugu just did such a terrific job owning that woman.
Talking to some of the other characters in the film, Mundy, Chris O'Dowd's character, makes a really big impression. He delivers a lot of laughs all the way through, but he also gets a really horrible death. Where did you come up with the idea for his demise?
You know, we were kind of playing around with just all the different ideas of crazy things that we thought could end up in this movie. Magno Putty was something that came up after seeing some real magnetic putty on the internet. And we thought, Jesus, we haven't seen anything like that in a movie before. What if we played around with this thing and what the possibilities were? So, you know, that death kind of came from us just, you know, doing the R&D of, like, could we actually make this effect work? And then also, you know, in what way would that affect one of the characters in the film? And, you know, Mundy, Chris did such a great job with, because it's hard to be that kind of character in a movie sometimes, mm-hmm. and not, you know, just kind of feel like a throwaway or be flimsy. But he made Mundy still feel like this smart, real human being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in many ways, somewhat of an audience surrogate when you see all these crazy things happening, like he reacts or says the things that we might all be thinking. And, you know, who better to put up against Magno Putty than the amazing Chris O'Dowd? So it just made sense as we were, you know, exploring and writing and putting mm-hmm. it together.
Another question about Mundy. Who's controlling Mundy's arm? That gives them the instruction about Volkov. What can you tell me about that?
I think it's maybe the best question we've ever got. You know, I think that the feeling that we had when we were working on the movie was what is the weirdest, most bizarre, most frightening thing that could happen? You know, I love the idea of this arm being taken off, but but Mundy not feeling it. Like, it not, nope, no pain, but just suddenly his arm is gone, and mm-hmm. that felt strange. And then the idea that the arm suddenly sort of takes on a life of its own, and is somehow, you know, in a way that felt like, because we kept asking ourselves, like, if you were to have a nightmare, and you were to wake up and you said, I had this nightmare, and you described it, and it was something that was so irrational, mm-hmm. but the idea that you would have, you know, something happened like this, where, you know, not just that the arm disappears, but that the arm starts, you know, reappears, and then it communicates something. That the idea that this piece of equipment from the space station would go missing and end up in someone's stomach, that these mm-hmm. the worms would pop out, a woman would be in the wall. It's like all these things have very tenuous connections to, well, there was an alternate reality in which, but to me, it was as soon as they did this thing, they broke reality. Mm-hmm. And that what was happening was as much of a fever dream, twisted nightmare. So logical, rational questions. And I understand, you know, I would have the same question. Mm-hmm. But I think that, again, in a bit like, you know, like Poltergeist, when you say, well, is it there just to scare you and just, you know, these things there just to be weird? I guess that part of it was they just these characters that hopefully you connect with and you like, you suddenly find yourself, you know, as you know, with them as your proxy in a situation that is simply bizarre and simply terrifying and a bizarre fever dream. And that was really the intention. So there is no one spirit. Mm-hmm. There is no one force. One could argue, I suppose, that it's like somehow it's a version of Mundy trying to, you know, who's in this other dimensional space that's not a reality that we know, who becomes aware of it, who's trying to communicate with that Mundy. I mean, you can make arguments, but to me, there is no one answer. It's more the experience of it. Mm-hmm. That,
or you could just wait for the Cloverfield movie that'll be entirely from the point of view of the arm.
I would love that. I think our time's nearly up, so I'm going to just go for some real quickfire questions to finish off on. So in the credits, there are cameos from Simon Pegg and Greg Grunberg, both JJ Lucky Charms. Where are they in the film? Where can we look out for them?
I believe that Simon's voice, I think, is the second voice you hear audibly.
New stories.
And Greg is the Michael's friend on the phone, who works at Mission Control.
There's a Kelvin gas station, which has appeared in other Cloverfield films, and Super 8. There's the Slusho bobblehead on the dash. Mm-hmm. What other Easter eggs can people look out for in the film?
I mean, there's Togarado. There, you see that logo in certain parts of the space station. Mm-hmm. I think you hit the big ones, though. I mean, there's Slusho. You've had Kelvin. Kelvin shows up in a couple of different
Julius
places.
Julius had my favorite idea, which ended up not being the movie.
I know. Oh, God.
Should I think of this?
Oh, no, it was great.
I loved it.
It was, yeah.
Julius, it was my favorite thing. When the, during the spacewalk sequence and all this debris is flying around, there was a truck that was going around that was just there. And it was from the Cloverfield, 10 Cloverfield Lane. It was the truck from Stambler's truck. But it was one of those things that, once again, it was just, some people called it out as being too crazy. Mm-hmm. I loved it because I just thought it was so bonkers. But, some people felt it was too distracting. I thought it was amazing.
Another connection from 10 Cloverfield Lane. Donald Logue's character has the same surname as John Goodman's character. Again, was that coincidental or was that kind of a...
No, that was on purpose. Yeah.
Okay, so very final one. One thing I really liked that was just a silly little thing was the kids' TV program Bleep Bloop. What can you tell me about Bleep Bloop?
Bleep Bloop is a real thing that that Ben Schwartz and I did together years ago that we've just never done anything with. Mm-hmm. And when we had this beat where Molly, the little girl, was watching a video, we used it. And Ben and I have been talking about now we have to probably put it out there.
I'd watch a Bleep Bloop series, just saying. Cool.
Wait till you see the thing for real. It's ridiculous.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, guys. It's been great to speak to you about the film. And yeah, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Cool. Okay, so that was Julius Ona and J.J. Abrams talking to Ben Travis about the Cloverfield paradox. Before I want to get the film itself, the third act stuff, and spoilers, and some of the film's more inventive death scenes, let's talk about the way the film dropped and what this means. I think everyone, in fact, we talked about this in the podcast, the regular podcast, thinks that this is a brand new thing. But I feel it kind of, a new film drops on Netflix every week now without any hullabaloo or... Mm-hmm. There's a Jack Black film on Netflix which just appeared out of nowhere called The Polka King.
Yeah,
and I have no idea what it is. I have no idea. I'd never heard of it. Mm-hmm. No idea it was being made. And suddenly there it is on Netflix. How is that different from...
And the Will Forte comedy as well.
The Will Forte comedy, which debuted over here at the same time as it was playing in Sundance.
In Sundance, yeah.
No fanfare. There it is. Here's a movie. Go and watch it. How's that different from what they've done with Cloverfield Paradox?
I think maybe the difference in this case is this one did have a scheduled cinema release. Maybe it literally comes down to that. This one was, when I was putting together the preview of 2017 for Empire, we were actually looking for pictures of it at that point, and they kept sort of going, we'll see maybe some day, guys. But not today, but, you know, we'll get you some pictures one day. So it's been kind of on the schedule for a long time. It's been pushed back a few times, and... now it appears this way.
I think it's where the name recognition, like Cloverfield's been around for the last 10 years now, and Netflix has had some big films dropping on the service, and they had Bright, obviously, just before Christmas, but that was their kind of, we're here, we're making big blockbuster films, whereas Cloverfield was like, here's a series you already know, here's a film that you might already have been anticipating, and we've got it here now before you even really knew officially that it existed.
And what it does as well is that it created the excitement for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think whenever the film itself, I think it's probably fair to say, is not that great overall.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's fine. It's a really good cast, which gives it something. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting like sci-fi ideas in there. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to set the world alight.
And so this had a chance for people to watch it before really they realised that it wasn't quite up to the standards of 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is a very, very good film. And Cloverfield, which I have mixed feelings on, the first Cloverfield. But it still has a lot of great stuff going for it.
I remember all the build-up and being with my friends and kind of us all wondering, like, what is this film going to be? Mm-hmm. And then going on opening night, that whole excitement around it. I guess it's probably time to rewatch it and see how it stands up on its own. But that felt like an event at the time. I think they did a good job of, in some ways, trying to replicate that excitement, because more than any other Netflix film, this is the one where, on that Monday when it dropped, my entire Twitter feed was talking about it compared to other kind of Netflix films. Like you say, like The Polka King, no one on my Twitter was talking about The Polka King.
And there has been a massive trend for underperformance in thinky sci-fi recently on the big screen, up to and including Blade Runner 2049, which had all the promo in the world. Mm-hmm. That's got to worry you if you're Paramount, who had the film originally, and are kind of, you know, they haven't had a huge string of hits recently. They've had some high-profile losses, and I think they wanted the security of the Netflix deal. This way, everybody comes out smelling of roses. They took no risk whatsoever and got some money that covered the cost of this film and a bit more besides. Netflix managed a sort of publicity coup that got people talking about them, and the film probably got more eyes on than it would have gotten in the big screen.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that's what they said with Bright. If the numbers that Nielsen declared had seen 11 million people in America in the first weekend, apparently watched Bright, this is according to Nielsen, because as we know, Netflix never released the numbers.
Yeah.
11 million people, roughly $10 a ticket, that would have been $110 million opening weekend. That's I don't think Bright would have got that in the cinemas. So that's a huge, huge win. Mm. But at the same time, there's a flip side to that coin, and that is you make a film for the cinema. This isn't a Gareth Evans with Apostle situation or Duncan Jones with Mute situation, which is we have these films. And even Martin Scorsese with The Irishman. Mm. And no studio will make these films. But here come Netflix to back us. And we know going in that this is going to end up debuting on the small screen. And there's a different situation here.
This is more Alex Garland and Annihilation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I think ultimately, if your film is enhanced by a theatrical experience, that you may be a little bit annoyed about that. But then listen, this is all supposition. I'm sure Julia Zona is delighted that 8 trillion people watched the film at once. We've got some questions from people that I've just had being sent in. A lot of people are asking about Chris O'Dowd's severed arm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Namely, what was going on there? Writer's Block asks, should it have ended with Chris O'Dowd's severed arm making a jerk-off motion?
Yes.
The guys in the interview said, we're talking about how it could open up all the possibilities of future Cloverfield films, that they can be set anywhere at any time. And Julius Erna did propose a film told entirely from the point of view of the arm, which I think would be interesting.
Yeah.
We haven't seen that before.
No.
So that would be a thing. Maybe not a good thing.
No. Who knows?
Maybe the arm could team up with Ash's arm.
Oh, my God.
From Evil Dead.
High five each other.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, this is one of the things about this movie, because it's a fun movie as far as it goes. I enjoyed it at the time, but it's a movie that reminds you constantly that there are better films out there. So it's a movie that reminds you that Event Horizon exists, because you have...
always a good thing.
Always a good thing. You have a space station that appears to be taking on a mind of its own and appears to be trying to kill off the people on there, and maybe it's crossed over to some sort of Hellion dimension. You don't know that for sure, but that seems to be an indication. Obviously reminds you there's Alien. Exists because there's literally a chestburster scene. It reminds you that Evil Dead 2 exists because there's an arm with a mind of its own. And the end, and this is interesting because the first Cloverfield for me, shall we say, lovingly homages the end of Miracle Mile by Steve DeJarnatt. If you've never seen Miracle Mile, check it out. It's a really good film. And Cloverfield, the end of Cloverfield is very similar to Miracle Mile. And likewise, the end of this, where you have Roger Davies, Michael.
Yeah.
Yelling on a phone to people to stop something, stop something, stop, don't tell them not to come back, tell them not to come back, is so Halloween 3.
Mm-hmm.
It is so Halloween 3. But, that said, I love the severed arm. The severed arm just felt like it had wandered in, literally just appeared from a different film and was going, hey guys, how's it going?
For me, to be honest, so did the rest of Chris O'Dowd. I thought that was a funny character, but the film moves through some really weird tones. It starts off...
Yeah, tonally, it's all over.
Quite very kind of tense sci-fi build-up, and then you've got a little stretch that's full-on horror. You've got full-on sci-fi horror. You've got the woman turning up in the vents in the ship, and you've got... the worms bursting out of the Russian dude, and you've got all these kind of really creepy things going on. And then Chris O'Dowd's character comes to the forefront, and you get the arm, and you've got him spouting kind of really goofy comedy lines. And that was one thing that first time around, I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this, because I was enjoying the tense buildup, and I know we've seen some of this stuff before, but I felt quite intrigued by the situation, and then I felt that some of that humour that he brought into it really deflated that. But I did find the arm stuff fun, even if there was no real payoff for kind of how the arm knew anything.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? Because like if the other crew in the other dimension, if there was some kind of crossover there and they basically crossed arms and the arms were somehow still connected to what they knew in each dimension, like if you'd had two parallel crews somehow, that would have maybe been a cool way of communicating between them, and that would have been quite a funky, different
way to
deal with it.
It lent into that even more.
But that's not what it was in the end. And that's what I honestly thought it was kind of building to.
I kind of flat out asked them in the interview who was controlling Mundy's arm. And the answer was basically a kind of fun, who knows, infinite possibilities.
I think that's a nice get out for this entire film, isn't it? Who knows? Why is the ship alive?
Who knows?
Why does the ship appear to come to life to kill Chris O'Dowd's character in that scene? Because there's the magnetic stuff is happening, and you think that, you know, it's one of those, it's like a crazy Friday the 13th movie. It's a bit like Alien Covenant in that way, and it becomes people just being picked off one at a time, but not by a mass serial killer, by, I would assume, the ship itself. For example, you know, Tam's Sang Si's character, that seems to be the ship going, I'm going to kill you now with water and freeze you to death because of, I've turned into Eddie Izzard, you know, because of evil business. And the same thing with Chris O'Dowd. So you have the ship becomes magnetized, or the room becomes magnetized. But then it looks like the thing, it almost becomes an arm
kind of
that hooks around
into him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it looks like, I thought it was going to like jab through him, that it was going to basically kind of stab him and he just falls to the floor. But then he's kind of writhing against the wall and it's
I didn't take it that way. I took it as an attempt by the natural laws of the universe to, you know, rid itself of a parasite, almost like rid itself of a germ. Like it knows it's not meant to be here,
right?
And therefore, the natural laws turn on it
On
them. That was kind of how I read it, but it's maybe because I've read way too much sci-fi.
But because you have, maybe you can explain things that others cannot.
Bless your little cotton socks.
Why the wall starts eating Chris O'Dowd's arm in the first place?
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I'm not saying that specifically makes sense. I'm just saying that was how I took it at the time. I didn't take it as the ship, per se. I took it as nature.
I mean, kind of tying into that whole who knows thing, I thought it was quite interesting. You were talking about Halloween 3 and Evil Dead 2 and Alien. But the film that JJ and Julius, I think more JJ, brought up the most was Poltergeist, where he was saying that film is, you've got The Haunting, but it's not one specific spirit. It's not the traditional rules of a ghost movie, but it gives you that situation as an excuse, really, to just come up with all these cool, weird ideas that you just want to try and see what that would look like on the screen and how that would feel unnerving to watch. And that's what they were kind of going for here. So with that in mind, I can see that they were trying to do some fun things. I just wish that people are always going to watch these films looking for things to question. People love the theories and stuff around the Cloverfield movies and around basically everything that J.J. Abrams does. So I feel like that probably wasn't the wisest path to go down, because it just leaves everyone with more questions. And
But the thing is, it's all very well. I get what you're saying. And you know, and that's fair. Poltergeist is just a series of crazy stuff happening. But that kind of works because it is meant to be supernatural. It's meant to be just, you know, again, nature going completely batshit. that doesn't work so well with sci-fi unless you get into really sort of heavy, big concept sci-fi like 2001, which is perhaps what they thought they were doing here, to some extent at least.
Well, of course, it's interesting that the original title of this movie was The God Particle.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, and we know as well that the film was retconned and retrofitted to some extent, as was 10 Cloverfield Lane, to fit this into the Cloverfield universe. So I'm wondering if in its original incarnation, it was a bit Event Horizon-y, and they did use the Shepard, the particle accelerator, and it was successful, and they did discover God, essentially, or a God-type figure, or some sort of unseen entity.
So it's basically Event Horizon meets Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
If that doesn't sound like the greatest film ever made... I mean, that would be just
the
incredible.
Worst Star Trek film, Chris.
Yeah, I know, but it has that cool bit with Spock with the hover
with the boots. Yeah, that's and literally in the first 10 minutes, and then
Scotty
it's all
banging his head. That's fun. And then the rest is shit.
And
yeah,
the rest
okay,
is
fair
unbearable.
Enough.
Yeah.
But so maybe that was around in the original script, and gradually as it became a Cloverfield film, it just became a series of death scenes. And I enjoyed the. I was sad to see Chris O'Dowd's character go on Monday, but. It was a fun enough sequence, and Sang Si-yi's character had a really memorable death.
Yeah, I wondered, I didn't get time to ask JJ about this, but I did wonder if that was somewhat of a Lost reference. It felt very much like, if anyone's watched Lost, Charlie's death, where he's drowning and he's locked in a little underground room and he can't get out, and he puts his hand up against the glass. Somebody on the other side of the glass puts their hand on the glass. It kind of mirrored that beat for beat. That's probably reading into it a bit too much, but the JJ connection is there.
Is there, yeah.
And they're certainly stepping it up, aren't they? They're certainly stepping up the Cloverfield activity. The first one was 2008, then we had 8 years before Cloverfield Lane, and now 2 years before this one. And we know there's another one, which will probably be theatrically released, which is Overlord, which appears to be a World War II movie, possibly set around D-Day.
That would make sense.
That would make sense. And you know what? I'm all for this. I'm all for a low-budget Cloverfield movie every year if it explores a different genre. I don't necessarily mind, and we're going to get into this in a second because we have a question. I don't necessarily mind about them linking up. I don't mind about the events in one movie seeming to contradict events in another movie or multiple universes, all that sort of stuff. If this is just a huge big screen / small screen anthology series... Twilight Zone stuff going on, and I'm quite happy. Yeah. And in that case, if it's one every year, then you can have the odd stinkeroo.
I think that's partly why the Netflix stuff around this was such a good move, because I am still as excited as I ever would have been for the next Cloverfield because of the anthology style, because it's going to be totally different to this, just as Cloverfield Paradox was totally different to 10 Cloverfield Lane. So now it makes the narrative around this one, it wasn't so great, but do you remember when it came out on Netflix and we all watched it at the same time? And that's what it's going to be remembered for more. And we'll all move on when the next one comes around. And hopefully that'll be have a bit of a smoother release and a smoother production as well.
Okay, so here's a question from Dan Moorhead via Twitter. Are any of the events across the films taking place in the same Earth, or are we seeing monsters and aliens appearing across the multiverse? It's a similar monster at the end of this movie to the first Cloverfield film, but much, much bigger.
So, well, depending on the height of the cloud cover, but yes.
So I asked them about this, and it took me a long time. If the answer is indeed right, and it does come from JJ and Julius themselves, it took me a long time to wrap my head around this. So I asked them if it is the same creature that we see in the original Cloverfield, if it's the same one. JJ said it is the same creature, it's definitely bigger. And Julius said it was a baby in the first one. So it seems to suggest that the original Cloverfield and the first Earth we go to in Paradox are the same. And that this is, they're like non-linear sequels. So at the start of Cloverfield Paradox, there has been no monster activity, but it's 2028. They go to space, they do the bad thing, which then disrupts time, allowing 20 years earlier in 2008, the original Cloverfield New Yorkie stuff to happen. So then by the time she is coming back down to Earth, there has been 20 years of Cloverfield madness.
What?
And the creature.
Wait,
has
does
got
it have to be
bigger.
The same Earth though? If it's
it
the same
baby.
Monster,
right?
We get it's the same monster, right? But it could have come through the rift after. So this Earth doesn't have to have been under attack for 20 years, is what I'm saying.
That is also true.
Because also in the film, it seems like they're only under attack for a night. Or a couple of nights.
It seems to have been a fairly recent event. But then again, you are getting into paradoxical territory, so what we're seeing may not represent what comes to have happened.
What? No. It's hurting my brain. But you're right. It does seem like the first one was a baby. And of course, at the end of Cloverfield, there is a garbled transmission, which I believe if you can unravel it, says something along the lines of, it's still alive, or it didn't work, or because they try and kill it at the end with fire, and it doesn't seem to have worked. That's intriguing, but certainly 10 Cloverfield Lane, which has got aliens and spaceships and all sorts of stuff, that seems to be something else. So whenever they fire the Shepherd, and as we know, the 18 minutes 20 seconds thing appears to be nonsense.
Coincident.
So the theory goes, and this was uncovered by someone very very quickly, I think it was on Reddit, that if you play Cloverfield and Cloverfield Paradox side by side, at 18 minutes and 20 seconds into Cloverfield Paradox, they fire up the Shepherd, the particle accelerator, and that's when the monster is first heard in Cloverfield. All right.
Wow.
Which is a Wizard of Oz, Pink Floyd, convergence of events, but. Apparently, and this is from JJ himself, that was a complete coincidence, and he was very tickled when I told him that theory, and he said, no, it happenstance. So we can scratch that one off the list, but it's still baking my noodle, I have to say. So the idea is clearly when they fire up the Shepherd that it unleashes Cthulhu and his hordes and or whatever it is, and they go into all these different dimensions at the same time. So we can say probably the 10 Cloverfield Lane doesn't take place the same.
Yeah, that seems to be
timeline,
kind of parallel dimension.
Yeah,
because it's the boundaries between the dimensions and space and time. They've opened all the possibilities here, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, that seems to be a totally different situation.
Why is that?
Who knows?
Did they say it had to be a parallel world for 10 Cloverfield Lane?
They didn't say that.
Okay,
but
why do we think that?
Because that takes place in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So if the events of Cloverfield had already happened,
mm-hmm.
then they would know about them. But that takes place in a world which hasn't been ravaged by monsters or aliens at the very, very beginning. And Michelle's only in that bunker for a couple of weeks.
Well,
or months, rather.
Here's my thing about that.
Okay, we're going to the part. Am I going to take up my spreadsheet again? And
possibly.
Oh, God.
I mean, the way I read it when I originally watched it was that New York might have happened in New York, but that was then, and then there was nothing. And then everything went bananas again.
Uh-huh. With aliens.
Yeah.
And then, but the aliens are clearly not around at the beginning of Paradox, which is why that might be a different world.
Unless when time was opened up, it went backwards, which we know it will, in fact.
Yeah. Okay.
From Overlord.
So you're saying this could all be the one Earth.
Yeah. Because now all bets are off and everything can take place in the same universe because what had happened before is no longer necessarily what happened in the past.
All right. Okay. But what about, and a lot of people have asked about this, the shot in Cloverfield where you see a small bit of what looks like debris fall to the ground?
I asked about this
initially. Okay.
So all the viral marketing stuff around that at the time said it was a Japanese space station. They kind of made some little like viral news stories to kind of go alongside that. I think it was, they said it was more of, they had, one thing that I asked them in the interview was if when the two universes collide and you've got both space stations at the same time, one knocks the other out of the sky in the universe that they travel into, and that falling to Earth, and also you've got the little shuttle that they're in at the end, was that some kind of reference to the original with the something falling out of the sky? And again, it was a kind of they're not sure answer, but they said they had fun kind of coming up with things to drop out of the sky so that people could make those connections for themselves.
I love the not sure answer, which basically means in 2008 we didn't know what it was, and we didn't think we'd be making something 10 years later, and here we are, and it doesn't really, the dots don't really join.
No.
But it's fine. Whatever you do, do not make a podcast that tries to pick this apart.
I really wish that they'd shown some kind of totally different monster at the end of Paradox, because it it would have kept them all the films quite nicely separate, where you go, okay, this is the reason why it happened, because in one of the universes, somebody did the bad thing with the particle accelerator, and now across all different dimensions, weird stuff is happening, but the weird stuff that is happening is different in every dimension. Whereas using the original creature at the end spews up a whole person full of worms in terms of the timelines and that kind of thing. I also would have just liked to see a different type of monster, because
it was really ugly monster to begin with. It was a really unpleasant design.
I enjoyed at the end of 10 Cloverfield Lane, spoiler alert, but this is a spoiler podcast, that when you see the sort of alien creature, it's totally different. It looks nothing like the original Cloverfield monster, or even the little ones that fall off it.
Yeah.
So I would have quite liked to see some totally different creature.
All right, we'll wrap this up very, very quickly, but we have another question here from Chris the Second, who asks, for both this and 10 Cloverfield Lane, do you think it would have been better had they not been Cloverfield movies in terms of name and advertising? Because both were clearly meant to have twists at the end, but in his opinion, ruined by the fact that we know that they're in the Cloverfield world.
I don't think I wasn't ruined. I didn't feel ruined in either case. I feel like the first one was, 10 Cloverfield Lane. I mean, the ending of that was just such a left turn that I thought it felt unexpected despite the name of the film. And it feels weird and bizarre and quite satisfying in a strangely unsatisfying way. And the same kind of with this one. This one I did a bit know was coming just because of stuff. But it was kind of an interesting note to end on and an interesting hook to end on as well.
Yeah, I like that these are both Cloverfield films, that they've come out as Cloverfield films. I think it's a really good avenue for filmmakers who will get a chance to direct a film with big budget, or not big budget, with kind of wide appeal, with name appeal, that people will go out and see because of that name connection. But largely, they are still the films that the filmmakers set out to create. There's a lot of creativity within the franchise that you can do whatever you want with it. I, like Helen, really liked the end of 10 Cloverfield Lane. I loved that twist that it's both. He is crazy, he's a horrible man, but there also is an alien invasion outside. So if you go out, you're going to die. Mm. I felt like one of the things with this one was that it didn't really have a twist, it didn't seem to, and I guess that was slightly disappointing. It would have been interesting to see, like you said, if there was some kind of element about them enraging God or discovering the kind of power to create or change life, and that has repercussions. Whereas this just seemed, that they had.
I think there were twists all the way through, but I don't know if there was a big twist. The non-twist that I thought was quite funny was the revelation that Elizabeth Debicki, as Jensen, who appears looking, apart from the fact that she appears in great pain, but for the rest of the movie, she just sits there looking sinister and evil. Turns out to be sinister and evil.
What?
She's kind of got right on her side a little bit. You know, she's trying to do it for the future of her humanity and whatnot, but yeah. When your bad guy turns out to be, when the obvious screaming bad guy turns out to be the bad guy, I thought they could have worked on that one a little bit more.
Yeah, they maybe could have. I did think that the revelation that Ava's children were alive in the alternate dimension, that was a bit of a gut punch. You could feel that one. That hurt, and that did make you wonder for a moment. Okay, how's this going to go?
Yeah,
but only a moment, because you're like, nah, she's going to do the right thing.
Yeah, although she sends a video message to herself saying, "Don't do that thing that you wouldn't do." Because I've done it, but you clearly haven't done it, so you're not going to do it. But, you know, she doesn't have much faith in herself, in her alternate self.
But then, I mean, that is actually quite logical, because if there are actual, you know, exact duplicates of people in this alternate dimension, then ultimately the population has to be pretty similar. Mm-hmm. So she has reason to believe that her children will die. Mm-hmm. In the alternate dimension, even if they didn't die at exactly the same moment, because otherwise the population would look completely different.
Well, you're right, because this alternate dimension has the makeup of the crew is exactly the same, bar one.
Yeah,
and the only difference really is that Schmidt, the Daniel Brühl character, is an evil baddie in the alternate dimension, but a heroic goody who survives to fight another day in this one. Or does he? Because they might just be food now for the big Cloverfield monster. And
I did rewind and see if I didn't know the first time I watched it whether it literally fell into the monster's mouth.
That would be a kind of the end of Deep Rising. Now what?
another film of them inside the monster, inside the pod.
Yeah, but I don't mind the fact that these are Cloverfield films. I think it's quite fun. We've talked constantly in the podcast about, you know, how other studios have tried to replicate the Marvel model without success. This isn't doing that. This is going about it in a kind of nutty, kind of retconned kind of way. And I quite frankly feel that if this movie had been released as God Particle, and if Cloverfield Lane had been released as, I believe, The Fault, we wouldn't be talking about them. They'd be fun little movies that would popped up, probably been reviewed in Kim Newman's Video Dungeon in Empire. Maybe pick it up if you see it on Netflix or Amazon a year or so down the line. But no one will be talking about them right now. But as it is, they form the basis of what I think is one of the most interesting burgeoning franchises. It won't get everything right. I don't think this is entirely right, but it's certainly one to keep an eye on.
Mm, I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the difference between this and, say, Skyline or something like that. You know, it's this has gotten more love, even from us.
Indeed, indeed. A good note in which to end. That is it for us. It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ben.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to be retrofitted into the Cloverfield franchise.
Ooh, where are the monsters coming from?
I don't want to know. No. Don't ask me that question. It can only end in tears. Literally and metaphorically. Thanks for listening. See you next time.